Hello there and welcome to another episode of Marketing Room 101. I'm Ben Norman, Strategy Director at Brandcom's agency Principles in Leeds, and this is the podcast where I invite marketers for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. And I'm especially excited about this week's guest, Kev Chesters, for two reasons. Firstly, as a strategist, I'm in absolute awe of Kev's career. He's held top positions at the best agencies in the country, including Ogilvy, Wieden & Kennedy, Saatchi & Saatchi. He's co-authored a book, The Creative Nudge. He's done a TED Talk. He lectures at universities across Europe. The list goes on. But aside from that, I was also looking forward to chatting to Kev because you never quite know what he's going to say next, but it will almost certainly be profoundly insightful or absolutely hilarious, often both. So here's my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Kev Chesters. Kev, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. The pleasure's all mine. So before we get really stuck into this, could you please describe what it's like in Marketing Room 101 for the sake of our listeners?
First off, it would be very noisy. I don't do well in noise. I think most planners don't. We like sort of quiet corners to have a bit of a think about things. I don't mind if I'm making the noise. So ironically, I think most people who know me would say that if I was annoyed by noise, I make a lot of noise, but that's okay. First off, I'm a planner. Second off, I'm autistic. So I find it's very distracting and discombobulating. And so, yeah, Marketing Room 101 would be noisy. I think the second thing it would have is I really don't like people who spend their time moaning. So it would probably have lots of people moaning about things. Maybe the noise, but yeah, just sort of moaners about everything. In my time, particularly as a manager or, you know, person who runs departments, you know, when you ask people to do things and then they spend twice as long as it would have taken them to do it, writing you an email to explain why they're too busy to do it. You know, or people moaning about how nothing's good anymore or everything was better in the good old days. Yeah, moaning. So noise and moaning, that's not what we'll get rid of, by the way.
I like that. I think a lot of people have mentioned noise when a lot of people talk about what Marketing Room 101's like. I think it does come down to noise a lot, but I think that's reflective of open plan office culture, isn't it? I'm all for a noisy environment and that sort of environment that feels creative or feels like a buzzing studio. But at the same time, you touched on there, I suppose our job as strategists is to try and see through noise a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always described planning as basically separating the useful from the interesting, you know, and I suppose the noise is interesting in the world. It's everything that's noisy and distracting. And the planner's job is to look through it and find the interesting bit. I think the thing with open plan offices is everybody loves open plan unless it's mandated. I think there's a lot of things in this world. Yeah. That once they make you do them, you don't like it. I can always remember when I used to read so much as a child, and the only thing I could never read would be the book that your English teacher told you you had to read this term. And I think this is the problem with office mandates. Once something is mandated, what it kicks in your brain, I think, is anything that you're mandated to do, you automatically think must be shit. Because if it wasn't, why would they make you do it? And so you're sort of mandated to go to school. And if you don't go, they'll put your parents in prison. So in your head, you're like, right, well, I want to go to the park and play football. You're making me go to school. Therefore, school mustn't be something that I'm supposed to enjoy. And so I think that's the thing with office. I've seen it so many different ways people have tried to make it work. And it's good. But I think mandating that people go to the office 5 days a week. Right. Well, as I say, it's a psychological thing. If someone makes you do anything, I mean, we do know, you know, the whole thing about happiness, you know, what will make you happy? Well, luckily, we do have an answer to that. Dr. Fisher at the University of Wellington did a survey in 2011. 460,000 people across 63 countries to work out what makes human beings happy. And he got to the answer. It's autonomy. It's the ability to make your own choices. And so that's the thing against mandates. You know, we are happy as humans when we feel that we have a choice. And therefore, that's what I think is the psychological anti-mandate thing, which is if you feel that you haven't got a choice, conversely, it makes you feel unhappy, threatened. I mean, if you have to make people go into your office, it just makes me think it can't be that great a place.
So the answer to happiness might be the most useful thing to come out of this podcast.
Well, you can go and read Dr. Fisher's paper. He definitely did answer what makes you happy. And it's not holidays or, you know, money or all these other things that people think, you know, whether it's wealth or power or sex or all these things people chase. Fundamentally, what makes you happy is choice.
I guess a holiday could make you happy,
if you choose where to go. Where equally, if someone tells you where you're going, it could have the inverse effect. So yeah, no, I like that. So Kev, whilst I've been familiar with your good self for a while, it was only recently that our paths first crossed when we randomly ended up embroiled in a debate on LinkedIn. Now, if I recall rightly, I'd posted about my favourite ever car ad, which is Peugeot's The Sculptor. If anybody's not seen it, go and have a look. Somebody commented saying he thought it was the last of the great creative ads for any car maker. You called him out for talking nonsense, and I got stuck in doing as I often try and do in a very English sort of way, trying to find the middle ground. Now, in that exchange, you argued that people have always made good ads and bad ads, and that's still the case to this day. But I suppose what I want to know is if you believe that the quality of advertising as a whole is any better or worse today than it was back in the 90s, back into 2000s, or if you think it's a constant process of good and bad at the same time.
Yeah, I like your optimism of referring to any exchange on LinkedIn as a debate. Sort of debate in the same way as sort of Prime Minister's questions, I find. People just making their own point over everyone else screaming. But I think what got my goat a little bit about that response to your post was, you know, The Sculptor's a great ad, right? It's not my favourite car ad. My favourite car of all time is Skoda Cake, which was incidentally made after The Sculptor. So clearly it wasn't the last great creative ad for a car. And then I was thinking, well, what are my other favorite car ads? I was thinking Cog for Honda. I was thinking The Force for VW, all of which were made after The Sculptor. And then I got thinking about Honda in general, having worked on it at W&K and at McGarry Bowen. And then I thought about Impossible Dream. I thought about Everything We Do Goes Into Everything We Do. I thought about some of the Cannes Lion winning stuff I'd done for Honda, all of which was made after The Sculptor. So it's what got on my nerves about it, I think, was just this sort of weird habit there is on LinkedIn, particularly for sort of older creative types, just a sort of post that, you know, everything's gone to hell in a handcart since insert date that was always mysteriously about 25 years before the current date. I mean, I remember, you know, when I started working in advertising, which was 30 years ago this year, saying, oh, it's rubbish these days, Kev. It used to be much better. There's no decent ads. It's all been ruined by clients. No one cares about emotion anymore. It's all just been taken over by the bean counters. This was 3 decades ago, by the way. And I've kind of heard some version of that conversation once every month for the last 30 years. There have always been good ads made. There have always been some rubbish ads made. And 95% of all ads are completely forgettable landfill that it would be flattering to call them good or bad because they don't elicit any kind of reaction. What I think happens is two things. First off, what normally happens is there's a natural human tendency to much prefer a time when you were relevant and young and it was all exciting and it was all done for your benefit and it felt like the whole world was made for you, you know, in your 20s and your 30s, etc. And now I sort of see that a lot of the people who moan and say there's no good ads anymore are just really remembering a time when they were more relevant or they felt more listened to. But I think when it comes to ads, most of the stuff, there's brilliant work being made by brilliant agencies on brilliant clients. Go and look at what Mother are doing. Go and look at what Nils and, you know, Lucy are doing at Uncommon. Go and look at what's coming out of Lucky Generals. Go look at what's coming out of VCCP. Right, there's amazing work. Look at the renaissance in Out of Home. Look at the amazing stuff that's been coming out of Saatchi & Saatchi recently, right? There's great work happening. The bit, though, that I find interesting is I did out my parents, my family home, you know, sort of doing a house clearance there over Christmas. And because my mum didn't tidy up that often at the bottom of the drawers, there was a lot of newspapers from like the 80s and 90s. And you open them up and all the ads were just ads. You know, here's a camera and it's 1999. Here's a this, here's another car, here's a new, you know, whatever. We remember the brilliant stuff. It's the same with music. It's the same with sitcoms, films. What happens is the brilliant stuff survives. So you see it all the time on top 10 films or top of the pop, you know, retrospectives. You remember the good stuff, but then also that stuff has a survivorship bias. It's survived and come with us. You know, for every Fawlty Towers that was made in the 70s, there were 50 Mind Your Languages or George and Mildred. You know what I mean? But we don't talk about that, do we? You know, and so for all the great music or sitcoms or films or ads that were made in the 80s, it was equally a load of sort of forgettable, pappy landfill. It just tends to get my goat a bit. And what I should have learned is just to sort of nod along and ignore it. But I do you know what? My serious point is, we want to attract great, inspiring, inspired, exciting talent. And we're not going to do that by sitting around moaning like something out of Last of a Summer Wine. There's a reference for the Gen Zers. We're not just going to sit around moaning about how life used to be great. You can do this from history. Look at, like, you know, Aristotle or Seneca. You know, you read all these people and all their writings are full of them going, oh, life's gone to hell in a handcart. Teenagers don't respect their parents anymore. It's not as good or as creative as it used to be. You know, and this is like ancient Greece.
And statistically, now is the best time in history to live, isn't it? If you look at a global scale, you know, the older we all are, the better we all were is the saying that comes to mind for me with this. Yes, I do like to share ads that I think are great from any era, but you know, you just reeled off a big list of amazing work that's coming out of not just global advertising, but just in the UK alone. I think it's quite refreshing to hear somebody celebrate that and talk in positive sense.
You look at some of the great independent agencies, you know, in New York still, you know, you got your Jones and your Johannes Leonardo's, and then you look at your place in Europe, like your gut. There's great work coming out of great places. It's just weird for me and unhelpful. Mm. I find particularly irritating when it comes from sort of people who, you know, if you don't want to get involved and you don't want to make it better, get out of the way. Don't just sort of sit about saying, oh, wasn't it brilliant in the early 80s? I mean, yeah, bits of it were, but, you know, for every band like The Jam, there were another 10 like Tight Fit.
Great reference. I wonder if we were to assume that the number of great ads being produced is relatively static, what maybe is at play is, since the entry point for audiovisual advertising has dropped and dropped over the past 20 years, it might be that we are exposed to more dross, but that doesn't mean that there's any fewer great ads being made. Since digital platforms have allowed people to put content up there with no minimum spend, it's lowered the entry point. So maybe we are seeing more rubbish ads. Maybe we are seeing more ads that are just telling you to buy something. But I suppose that always still existed in the back pages of magazines.
Well, it did. And also, maybe I'm just a bit overexcited by the world, but I was going to go, well, why see the advent of platforms like TikTok as sort of the end of days? You know, there were an awful lot of people around, you know, when cinema first started moaning about the demise of radio, or when talkies came out that suddenly, you know, the whole of cinema was going to go to hell in a handcart. I see the advent of these platforms as amazing in the same way, you know, there are problems with AI, of course, there always will be, but equally, all of the best things that are coming out on AI are being produced by brilliant creatives. So the great photographers understand the right prompts to use AI and photography in the right way. You know, the great filmmakers do. Of course, there's PAP, but there'd be PAP if you gave me a violin and asked me to play it. You know, I mean,
it's, yes, that's a great point. There are people making rubbish films, rubbish ads for TV, rubbish TV programs, and like you said, rubbish music. That doesn't mean that there are any fewer people making great stuff, right?
You probably, like you say, because there's more stuff out there. What it probably means is that you have to put a little bit more effort into finding the good stuff. But there's plenty of it out there. I just think, you know, I feel like that there's still, in whatever field it is, there's still great people doing great things. And there is a natural tendency for humans to moan and whine. I mean, to your earlier point, according to people like Steven Pinker in things like The Better Angels of Our Age, if you look at the stats, any stats you want to look at, we've never lived in a safer, happier, calmer, more enlightened time than we live in now. We often think we're not, but you just have to compare it to history. Yet, weirdly, global optimism rates are going through the floor. I mean, the optimism rate in the UK is running at 4%. The only country in the world where it's running significantly high, interestingly, is China, where it's running at 43%. But most of Europe is in the single digits, same as the US.
Yeah.
And as the world gets better, just to delve into the behavioral science of it, it is based on a principle which is known as hedonic adaptation, which is that humans have a tendency that what we do is we assimilate all good things as normal. So the moment something really good happens, or a new technology or a new innovation, we assimilate it and it becomes normal life. And what we then do is just moan about the downside. So a good example is the speed of in-flight Wi-Fi. Rather than marveling that all the world's information is now available to us for free, anywhere we want, at any time, on a device we have in our pocket, and even better than that, it's available to us in the sky in a tube traveling at 600 miles an hour at 30,000 feet, we'll moan, goodness me, a bit expensive, isn't it? Running a bit slow, isn't it, today? You know what I mean? Rather than just marveling that this thing even exists in any way. And it was a defense mechanism. What you had to do was you edited out the extraneous to focus on the threat. And so that's why the human brain assimilates the good stuff and focuses on the bad, because all it's doing is just mirroring that sort of 50,000-year-old process.
That's the same theory as to why money isn't the cure to happiness, isn't it? The idea that it's change that drives happiness as opposed to having more money. So you'll feel the immediate increase for about 6 months when you earn more money, and therefore you will be happier. And then once you've adjusted to the status quo, you're then no happier than you were 6 months before.
Yeah, I mean, the other part of that, though, which I always think is really interesting, is it's normally discussed by people who've got a few quid. I mean that relatively. So money will not bring you happiness, but being poor...
And
won't make you happy either. I think so that's the thing for me, which is you do assimilate it, the money. Money won't bring you happiness, but interestingly, what more money will bring you is choice. And what makes you happy? Choice. So once you've got enough, that's the key word, enough. Which is why the reason that mega rich people are not particularly happy is because they don't understand the concept of enough. They just want more and more and more and more and more. It's also, by the way, your point about why the majority of people, I think it's like 95% of people who accept a counteroffer when they're going to leave a job are not in that same job 12 months later. Because the money is enough to make you forget why you were leaving. And then you sort of remember when it slightly wears off after about 3 months.
The novelty. No, I totally agree with all of that. Now, it wouldn't be an interview or a discussion with Kev Chesters if we didn't talk about creativity. You have, of course, written a book on the subject, The Creative Nudge, available in all good bookstores. And whilst I would encourage people to read the actual book, could you please just share with listeners your definition of creativity? Because I found it particularly interesting. I thought it was actually quite empowering when you talked about how you define creativity and the difference between that and creative craft.
Yeah, and it's not how I define it. It's how the dictionary defines it, which is normally a good place to start. All agencies are creative, right? Just as all people are creative. You can't teach anyone to be a creative. You can only teach them not to be. I want to say a creative. I am not saying that everyone has creative executional skill. There are specific executional skills that the best creatives and even the average creatives have that I will never have. But all creativity is, if you read it in a dictionary, it doesn't mention drama or dancing or painting or poetry. It doesn't mention three-quarter length jeans in Hackney. Doesn't mention any of that stuff, right? If you look up what the word creative means, it is the pursuit of the new. It's new, it's different, right? That's what it is. So you won't find a new world with an old map. So you have to go somewhere new. Edward de Bono said, creativity is the key to all progress. So to move forward, you have to come up with a new answer. And so you can be creative in whatever field you choose. But yeah, so my definition of creativity is the dictionary definition of creativity. It's the pursuit of the new, coming up with new and different answers to problems. But humans find it almost impossible to be creative because it means coming up with new things. And in evolution, go back 50,000 years, anything new is highly likely to kill you or give you a very prominent physical scar. So when you see a new thing or your brain comes across a new solution, it wants to run away from it as quickly as possible. So you need to overcome your natural programming, your biology, which will tell you to run away, and your sociology, which is societal convention that wants you to fit in and do what everyone does. What The Creative Nudge, available from all good bookstores and Amazon, will do, it will help you overcome your natural programming through a series of nudges that you can incorporate into your daily life. So there's 9 chapters which explain the 9 rules for creativity or living a more creative life. It will then explain the biology and sociology, the nature and nurture that make that virtue impossible, and then give you the antidote and the nudges you might need to get over it, to be more creative in your life. Because Deborah de Bono equally said creativity makes a more happy, more interesting life. So the second book Mick and I are writing at the moment is about creativity, a life skill, not luxury. You know, people think it's a luxury. People think it's an optional extra that you do when you've finished everything else, whereas actually creativity is the key to everything. It enables humans to endure the unendurable, adapt to the unthinkable, and overcome the insurmountable.
I really like the framing that whole piece as creativity being the search for the new. I think tells creative agencies, but it also tells clients that it doesn't just have to be pigeonholed into that little department. The execution absolutely does, but your finance people should be empowered in a creative way. So should your commercial people. So should your account handlers. So should your strategy people. It should all be thinking about that search of the new, right?
That's the key thing, which is every single person who works in an agency should be creating the conditions for great creative to happen. Now, whether that's enough money or enough time or a better relationship with the client, all you're doing is like a farmer, creating the conditions within which things can thrive. Now, what I find curious, when I say curious, I mean maddening, is you'll sometimes hear people say, well, I'm not very creative. I've heard chief execs in front of the city or, you know, talking on quarterly calls saying, well, I'm not the creative one. You want to talk to this lady or talk to this guy. Mm. Well, can you imagine that same CEO saying in front of the board or shareholders or journalists, well, I don't think we should do anything new. I'm not someone who can think innovatively or come up with different and new solutions to problems. Again, right. Well, that's all creative the word means. What you mean is I can't draw or take a challenge like a glass and a half of joy and write an advert with a drumming griller. Yeah, I know, mate. Most people can't. Madonna once sat in a quiet room and heard like a prayer in her head. You know, I mean, I can't do that. And it's my biggest bugbear with the term best practice. Mm. Have we got any best practice? In most cases, what they mean is a lazy, obvious solution someone else has done, which will save you from having to bother doing any work or thinking.
Yeah, it's something I've discussed on a few episodes recently, the idea of trying to create the rule book for great creative. What are the rules and laws? And there are rules and laws, as there are in most areas beyond marketing, but they should be there to give you some guidance, but they're not there to tell you how to make the damn ad, are they?
Everybody is always trying to industrialize creativity. They come up with this silly sort of the way, the something way, the whatever way. Six silly alliterating chevrons that apparently if you sort of follow this, somehow you'll get something brilliant at the end. And it's a bit like the sort of advertising equivalent of buying Slimmer's tea. Do you know what I mean? There's all these sort of products where people think there's somehow a shortcut to it, whereas actually all you do is you burn off more calories than you put in your body, eat less, move more, and you'll lose weight. It's not a complicated equation. Everyone worked it out years ago.
No. So you're here today because you would like to banish something from the marketing world forever. Can you please now reveal, Kev, what you would like to banish?
Yeah, and I think it's entirely selfish of me to do this. But for the last 2 years, I've been working on my own. I've set up my own business. I work directly with my own clients, either working on strategic problems or training. I have 10 training modules that I run for clients. And the thing that I really want to banish forever is tire kickers. So no one's got enough time these days, and everyone's being asked to do twice as much in half the time with a quarter of the budget, right? So we haven't got any time to waste. And I think on behalf of every contractor, solo operator, agency, or freelancer out there, people who waste your time when they haven't really got any intention of buying, they're asking you for proposal after proposal, asking you for meetings here and meetings there, and it's always tantalizingly just a little further out of reach. You know, first off, I mean, I hate ghosting people who just ask you for things, then you never hear from them. That's just rude and infuriating, and there's a special place in hell reserved for those people.
Yeah, I think that might be, to be honest, from my experience, that might be my marketing room 101 one day. So I think ghosting is the worst, isn't it?
Well, actually, I'm going to say there's a worse one than ghosting. And it's the concept I was introduced to about a year ago of breadcrumbing, which is if people ask you for something and then disappear, that's ghosting. If people ask you for something and then ask for another meeting where they ask for a little bit more and then another one where they ask you for a little bit more, normally where you're paying for things like lunch or coffees or dinner, and then they disappear, the breadcrumbing, that is even worse than ghosting. But the bit that I would ask people, this is the probably more selfish element of it. One of the things I've come across over the last couple of years, and a lot of friends of mine have also talked to me about this, so I know it's not just me, I know it's prevalent, is people who ask you for things who don't really have the money to pay you. So this is the kind of tire-kicking bit that really irritates me, when they sort of, and I will make it a personal thing for me, which is, like, so I have 30 years experience. I'm an ex-CSO, you know, I was a CSO for over a decade. So, you know, they kind of know that you'll be expensive, right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, that's a weird term because, you know, if, I think as Red Adair said, if you think it's expensive to hire a professional, wait till you hire an amateur, you know, because then you'll just have to do it three times and then pay someone decent to do it anyway. You should have paid in the first place. But it's that thing of sort of asking people for things. Then when you're just about to, you know, hit the go button, they turn around and say, oh, how much is it? Oh, sorry, no, I've only got a tenth of that. This is why, and I plan to write a very long LinkedIn post that no one will ever read about this pretty soon, is that the most important question you ask, and it sounds weird to be the first question you ask, because we're not encouraged in our industry to do this. And there's that old theory of Oscar Wilde's that a gentleman doesn't sully his hands with commerce. But I do think that the first question you should ask anybody is, how much money have you allocated to solve this problem? Because then we can cut the clothes according to cloth. If you went into a travel agent and said, hello, mate, I'd like a holiday. And they said, well, how much have you got? And you went, well, I don't really know. Can you just sort of come up with some holidays and I'll decide if I like them? It's like, well not really, because it could be a weekend in Canberra Sands or a month in the Maldives, and they're quite far apart. You know, I mean, you wouldn't do it with a wedding planner. I'd love a wedding. How much money have you got? I don't really know. Can you just come up with a big load of weddings with different cakes, photographers, venues, and caterers, and then I'll tell you which one I want?
You can solve this in two ways, can't you? You can either give me a very clear scope and I can tell you what that's going to cost. You could say, I want 2 weeks in the Maldives in a decent five-star hotel and blah, blah, blah. Fine, you don't need to give me a budget because I can tell you what that's going to cost. Or you can say, I've got $5,000 to spend. Where can you get me?
Exactly. I think that's the thing. Either tell me what money you've got and we'll cut the clothes according to the cloth. Or, like you say, tell me exactly what you want and I'll tell you how much it's going to be. And I think it does lead us actually neatly onto a thing I'd bring back.
Okay. So what is it you'd like to bring back?
So I would like to bring back considered, well thought out, written client briefs.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's music to my ears.
I don't want to get into rosy retrospection with it, but a good brief really is worth its weight in gold. So 1/3 of all marketing budgets globally are wasted on rebriefs. Okay. So if no one's got enough money, it's probably a good idea not to waste 1/3 of it. Okay. Yep. So I just think, as my grandma would say, measure twice, cut once. Thinking about your brief and what you want, and it goes to that thing of scope and costing that we were talking about a minute ago as well, but really thinking hard about your brief, because the issue that I've noticed is that clients seem to spend so long writing the agency's brief for them that they forget to write the marketing brief. So they tend to write all the questions that are on the agency's brief and fill them out. Where, why are you telling the agency what's the thing you should say?
Yes.
Right? I mean, you wouldn't buy a guard dog and then sit by your front door barking yourself. You've just paid these people a lot of money. They will know what to say. Your job is to frame the problem that you've got and then explain, from a marketing point of view, what solution you've come up with that you believe will solve that problem for the audience, the who and the what, right? Then give that to the people that you're paying very good money to solve it. Don't solve it yourself. But I think what's happening is clients are forgetting to write their own brief because they're getting a bit obsessed with writing the agency's one. And that's what I would bring back. I think good, solid, well thought through briefs that frame the problem that you face and the solution you've come up with that you think will solve it. I mean, unsurprisingly, Ben, I do run a course on this for clients. I've run it for a number of clients, both here in the US and in Europe. I was just recently doing it with Adidas. I'm about to do some work with OVO on it. And good, smart clients understand this because they understand that a good brief is the key to good work. It's not complicated. It's all about focus and brevity. Focus the brief, work out what it is you want to say rather than just dumping everything into a document. So yeah, that's it. That's what I'd bring back. Good client briefs.
Where's the saying? I can't remember who it was, but a brief, the clue is in the name, right? You talked about brevity and focus there. And I think I tend to experience a few different types of brief. I think the first type of brief I experience is where I'll get sent absolutely everything with no context. So I'll get sent, here's a document we did 2 years ago. Here's this. Because I think, and I can understand why, if you don't have a clear idea of what you're doing and you want an agency to help or you want someone to help you with that, it makes you feel better to send, I've sent them loads of information. The answer must be in there somewhere. Equally, I get the other briefs on the other side, which is, well, you're the experts. You tell me what I need to do. And then, you know, the true answer is somewhere in the middle, isn't it? It's like you do the hard work and gather all that information together, but then do something with it without trying to come up with an ad, without trying to come up with a headline. Like, actually, give me a very clear idea of your commercial situation. Who's the decision maker? What are you actually trying to achieve with this piece of work? What's the problem we're solving? Who is the audience that you want to speak to? Look at some really clear commercial objectives and then pass that on to us and we'll do the hard work. Yeah. But I don't know if that aligns with what you train.
I mean, one of the things that I've talked to clients a lot about in this course that I run is separating business objectives from marketing objectives from communications objectives.
100%, yes.
Separating business problems from marketing problems from communications problems. Because the amount of times I've seen even an advertising brief where the success criteria has virtually nothing to do with advertising.
Well, how often do you see a campaign brief where you know the answer really is probably more related to mental availability or something, but we need to increase sales by X percent in this next quarter, or sales are declining for this brand. That's good to know the business problem, but what's your marketing objective to solve that?
Yeah, I mean, probably the stupidest brief I ever received was on a Friday afternoon when the chief exec of this client sent a sort of one of those ridiculous emails to my chief exec. It was for a bank. And this individual said he wanted blue sky thinking, you know, brave solutions out of the box on how to get 1 million new current account customers for the bank in the next year.
Right.
Which, of course, like any chief exec, he forwarded straight on to me. And so what I said was, okay, clearly, the agency was worried about losing the account, so we were going to do something over the weekend for some bizarre reason. But the numbers were, in order to get to 1 million new current account customers, what they'd have to do is quadruple the UK rate of account switchers of all current accounts for the next 7 years, and then capture 100% of that market to reach the number 1 million. So clearly, it was horseshit. Right? Yeah. They currently had 4% of current accounts in the UK. They got 4% of switchers. Sorry, they didn't even have 4% of current accounts. So I think sometimes that thing of you get a brief and you're asked to write an advert or an ad campaign about it, whereas actually the marketing problem is normally a much bigger problem, of which comms is a small element, sometimes a significant element, but still not all of it. And then the business objective, if you look at the wider business, as I always say, you know, your world, the wider world, and the big wide world. So you've got your world, which is normally you, your brand, and your category. Then you've got the wider world, which is human behavior and everything within that topic, and in that case, money and all the things that come with that. And then you've got the big wide world, which is what's going on with everything from Putin to climate change, which is kind of the sort of existential mindset that people are in. There's only one logical thing to do in times of financial stress, and it's keep your money in your pocket, right?
Yes.
Not go for a cheaper solution. It's not to spend. So maybe the one and only time I quote a Korean proverb at you, Ben, you know, they have one, which is the frog in the well never sees the ocean. And I think often comms people or ad people sort of live in this well without realizing the sort of classic four P's. So I think that would be it for me. Work out the sort of the business versus marketing versus communications challenges and just stop worrying with the brief that, you know, it's not your English composition homework. Do you know what I mean? If it's got to be dull to be clear, be dull. And then hand it across to people who you're paying to solve it.
So I'm going to take tire kickers and breadcrumbers from you, and I'm going to keep them here in Marketing Room 101. And I am going to return considered client briefs to you that you can take and you can distribute all throughout the industry. Now, before you go, there is one thing I would like to ask. So in every episode of Marketing Room 101, my brother sends me a question to ask My brother doesn't work in the industry, but he sends me a question every week. He snuck in a double barrel question for you. He says, Kevin, you were once quoted as saying, I almost feel quite insulted when people refer to autism as a superpower. It's an incredibly distracting and debilitating condition for a lot of people. So, when you got your diagnosis later in life than perhaps some might, did it change anything for you overnight? Or was it more of a ratification of your history? And also, if you could have any superpower, what would it be?
So, it did change things in the way that it helped me to make sense of a lot of things that had gone on in my life, that you were able to look back and go, oh, almost in the way that if you read a good whodunit, when you get to the end, you should go back and read it again. And what it will show you is that every page that was written led you to that point. You didn't realize it at the time, but it was leading you to that point. And so it helped to explain a lot of things. I mean, my wife put it best when she said, yes, Kevin, it explains a lot of your appalling behavior, but it doesn't excuse any of it. So, but it did explain a lot of things. So it was useful. I found the label useful to sort of explain why I thought it was just me. In a lot of cases, and go, that's why I feel so exhausted after I've done a presentation. That's why I just want to lie in a darker room and eat a cheeseburger in my pants rather than go to the networking event. Do you know what I mean? All these things. I get apoplectically angry when people refer to autism as a superpower. In fact, any neurodiversity as a superpower, because I think it's a huge cop-out for corporate and organizations to go, we don't have to do anything. We don't have to create the conditions. We don't have to do whatever, because old Clark Kent, he'll be all right, won't he? Because he's frigging Superman. No, he isn't.
Yeah.
No, she isn't. You need to make allowances in situations and create the conditions within which everybody can thrive, no matter how diverse or different they are as individuals, because diverse teams come up with better answers, right? So it was useful for me, but I've also found it useful for understanding other neurodiverse people I've worked with. I'm very useful as a parent of two neurodiverse children to understand much better what they're going through and help them.
Well, was there a point that you thought, I might be autistic, that I'm going to get tested? How did that come about?
Yeah, it was interesting. I approach everything in my life like it's a brief. I always have, right? So when my eldest son was diagnosed autistic at the age of 17, it was seen that it was quite a late diagnosis. I thought to myself, how will I help him? What's the best way I can help him? As a boy, me as a boy and as a planner, my natural tendency was to solutionize. So I thought, okay,
yes,
what do I do? I thought to myself, well, if I was asked to do a pitch for the National Autistic Society, how would I approach it? I thought, okay, well, what I'd do is I'd listen to some podcasts, I'd watch some documentaries, I'd read some books, I'd go online, I'd go to the website of the National Autistic Society. I would understand, I would empathize, I would do what a good planner is supposed to do, put his or her herself in the shoes of the target audience and try and understand the decision-making process and the life that they were living. And as I was doing it, I kept saying to my wife all the way through, going, well, this is rubbish. Like, this says these are the 10 traits of autism. And they're not traits of autism. They're just traits of people. I do all of these things. But this test from America about, do you have Asperger's? I've done it and I've got 100% and I haven't got Asperger's. And my wife was just sort of, you do know, don't you, that people think you're a bit odd. I mean, nice odd, but odd. It might be worth maybe you getting tested. And so I did, and I was. Then when I got diagnosed, my younger son said to me, well, a lot of what you and Louis are talking about and the struggles that you talk about, I kind of think I'm a bit like that. And so we decided to see whether he had autism, and he did. So my wife went from having no autistic people in the house to having three in the space of 3 years. I happen to think she's the most autistic person in the house, but she's just refusing to be diagnosed.
You don't want to have you don't want the full house, right?
I think the house of autists would be amazing.
It sounds a little bit like one of those forgotten 1980s sitcoms you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, it'd be slightly irritating. It would go on a while, wouldn't it? But yeah.
Did you have a superpower in mind if you were to have a real superpower?
What I always thought was, to borrow Spider-Man's thing about with great power comes great responsibility, I always quite fancied not a superpower, but being able to like have one skill. I always loved the idea of being able to play the piano. But I was always shit. I tried it like when I was younger and I just wasn't any good ever at it. And mostly because I was lazy and had no persistence. So I'd love the idea of having a superpower, being able to just immediately switch on things like that. Just to be able to go piano and be able to play the piano, or guitar, be able to play guitar, Serbo-Croat and be able to speak Serbo-Croat. So I like that idea that I could somehow bend the world to my whim.
Like in the Simpsons episode where Bart wakes up one day just speaking fluent French.
Yeah, I'd love that. There was one quite funny story about that. Is my wife is French, right? I remember going over to France quite a lot, and I remember taking my 95-year-old grandmother. Now, at the time, she wasn't 95, she was 89, but she'd never been abroad. And she said she'd get on the plane as long as I sat next to her, and she wanted to come to my wedding. She didn't want to not come to my wedding. And when we got to my wife's house, she was sat there completely freaked out, obviously. Big house full of lots and lots of people. And my sister-in-law, Isabel, sort of took her under her wing and was chatting to her and stuff. And my gran took me to one side after about 2 hours and went, Kev, it's really strange. When Isabel talks French to me, I can understand everything she says, but I can't understand anything anyone else is saying. And of course, it's because Isabel was speaking 100% fluent English to her, but just with a French accent. So my gran just thought she'd somehow become this kind of overnight French speaker.
Brilliant.
But only with one person.
I love that. I love that logic. I think that's brilliant. Okay, Kev, before you leave, can you tell me how people can get hold of you, how people can thank you for coming on the podcast, how people can reach out to you if you'd like to work with you, and also point people in direction of those courses, because I think they sound brilliant.
So I'm the world's easiest man to find. You can just Google me, Kevin Chesters, and I won't be hard to find. You can go to kevinchesters.com, where you can contact me through that. You can look me up on the LinkedIns. That's always easy. I'm on there normally banging on about something or other. Yeah, like I said, I have 10 courses, everything from creativity to the science of story, to how to create more time in a world that's speeding up, to my favorite and most popular one at the moment, which is what all businesses, brands, or departments can learn from studying gangs. So I've studied all gangs from the US Army to the Salvation Army, from the Women's Institute to the Hells Angels, and they all share the same 10 characteristics, which if you apply them to your team, you'll be undeniably successful.
Sounds amazing. I've never heard the Women's Institute described as a gang before, but maybe it's going to see a massive rise in signups.
Well, if you look up the word gang in a dictionary, it says a group of individuals who share an aim, an objective, or a set of belief. I would say that the Women's Institute nails that.
Right. Kevin, thank you for coming in.
Absolutely my pleasure. Take care.
So that's my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Kev Chesters. If you enjoyed it as much as I did, I'd love it if you could just take 30 seconds to leave a quick review wherever you listen to your podcasts, because doing so tells Spotify and Apple, etc., to introduce more people to the show. And if you'd like to get in touch with me or keep up to date on new episodes coming out, just find me on LinkedIn under my name, Ben Norman. I'm the one with no hair. And if you'd like to know more about Principles, where I do my day job, just head to principlesagency.co.uk.